Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Everyone felt the same way. Small-town Nebraska widow Helen Wilson didn't have an ounce of meanness inside her body. Then on February 5th, 1985, on one of the coldest nights on record, the unthinkable happened. The 68-year-old resident was murdered inside her second-floor apartment. But why? Local residents were floored. What type of monster would target a vulnerable widow to fulfill his homicidal sexual fantasies? The crime scene was eerily ritualistic. The trail of evidence turned frustratingly cold until an astonishing breakthrough occurred 4 years later. A torn scrap of money recovered at the crime scene became the presumed smoking gun that helped solve the hideous crime. The news of six arrests was absolutely stunning to the locals in this easygoing blue-collar community of 12,000 residents. But why were six loosely connected misfits who lived as far away as Alabama, Colorado, and North Carolina being linked to the rape and murder of a beloved Nebraska widow? As they sat in jail, the constant threat of Nebraska's barbaric electric chair scared the daylights out of these troubled souls, except for one of them. Joseph White remained defiant in his fight to prove his innocence. It didn't matter. All six of the condemned were convicted of murder and sent away to prison for the ghastly crime. The town moved on, convinced that justice was served. For more than 25 years, the Beatrice Six rotted in prison until the unthinkable occurred in 2008. Now the red state in America's heartland faced a real quandary that could only mean one thing. Nebraska had a colossal failure of justice on its hands. The book that we're featuring this evening is Failure of Justice, A Brutal Murder, An Obsessed Cop, and Six Wrongful Convictions, with my special guest, journalist and author John Farrick. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, John Farrick.
Thanks for the opportunity to be back on the show, Dan.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible tale. I know I always say that, and I use that word, I overuse that word, but this is a wild tale. Anyway, John, congratulations on this. We're just going to jump right into this because we've got a lot to cover, and it's a fantastic, surprising, shocking, and amazing story all the way around. Let's start with introducing the audience to where this takes place, and that is in southeastern Nebraska, in, as we mentioned, Beatrice, Nebraska, population 12,000. Tell us a little bit about what it's known for, a little bit about Beatrice, Kansas, population 12,000, where it's located. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure, Dan. And just this is one of those weird quirks I'll just point out. Only if you spent time or lived in Nebraska, and I lived out there for 9 years, a handful of these communities have funny-sounding names. So the town is actually pronounced Beatrice. I would have thought that it was Beatrice. There's also another town that you would think is Louisville, but it's really Louisville. So it has these little oddities about it. But Beatrice, Nebraska, is a community. It's been about 12,000 people for about the last 50 to 60 years. Population has remained stagnant, hasn't gone up or down at all. It's a Christian community. It's considered a suburb of Lincoln, but to its own degree, it also has its own identity. It's probably best known in Nebraska for being a state development home. It's been a state facility for persons with severe and profound mental retardation, mental illness, going back 100 years. And on the flip side, it has some strong industry manufacturing. It's really well known. Really proud of the fact that it's known for its role in the lawnmower industry. It makes there's two or three big companies that have been around for a while that that make lawnmower equipment and lawnmower parts. So it's a robust community for a smaller community in Nebraska, whereas a lot of smaller towns in Nebraska, outside of Lincoln and outside of Omaha, have struggled the last 30 or 40 years as jobs have moved toward the big two cities in Nebraska. But Beatrice has still been able to hang on to itself and still retain that small town charm and identity. And for the most part, it's been a pretty safe community to raise a family and also a safe place to retire if you're a senior citizen as well, Dan.
Okay, now, and thank you for correcting me on the pronunciation, Beatrice. And so take us, as you do in the book, to 1983, in a string of very strange home invasions perpetrated against elderly women. Tell us about what happens in 1983 in Beatrice.
The summer of 83 was a terrifying time for this community, and again, just for our listeners, this is a time before the internet. So really, the only way, you know, for news to get out in a small community like that was usually through the local newspaper, you know, or word of mouth. And during the summer of 1983, there was a string of late night home invasions, and these home invasions all involved attacks upon elderly widows. These were women that were all in their 70s and their 80s that lived alone, and these attacks typically happened between 10 or 11 at night and as early as, I believe, 1 or 2 in the morning. These were scary events. All these situations, either the women were asleep or they were in their room watching television, and lo and behold, just all of a sudden out of nowhere, a young man who was around in his early 20s was standing on top of them, trying to attack and rape these women. In all these situations, the women were brave, and they fought back. And that seemed to do the trick as far as scaring this individual off. He seemed to be afraid of these women that would fight back. He figured he would get his way with them if they would cower to his advances. But to their credit, they all fought back or screamed or yelled, and that just scared him, and he ran off. And the police, to their credit, tried really hard to get the word out, you know, let people know about these attacks, figure out who the perpetrator was, but nobody really got a good look at him. So there was just vague general descriptions of a young man that looked to be around age 20 or so, early 20s, very thin, not of a muscular build, but beyond that, there really wasn't much for the police in Beatrice to go on. And what really became odd then is that as the police were preparing, you know, for this individual's next attack, trying to figure out where he might strike again in this community, all of a sudden the attacks stopped. So there had been three or four attacks in about a very short radius. I believe it's mentioned in the book, but I think a police officer had pointed out that if you drew a circle around the whole area, we're only talking a 4 or 5 block, you know, radius as far as where all these attacks occurred. But bottom line is these attacks stopped after the summer of 1983. Fall comes, Winter comes, 1984 comes and goes, and nothing ever happened again. And for the most part, the community forgot about this perpetrator, this deviant, you know, that was preying upon elderly women by the time 1985 rolls around, Dan.
Now let's introduce the victim of this story, Helen Wilson. She's about 5 foot tall, and she's almost 69 years old. She's going to celebrate her birthday soon, and she's a very small, slight woman, longtime widow. Her husband had died quite a while ago in a close-knit family. So tell us about her sister Florence and her son Daryl, and what Helen was like and what her life was like and where Florence lived. Just tell us about that whole situation and what they were doing on February 5th that evening as a family.
Yeah, that's correct. So Helen had been a widow for many years. Her husband died unexpectedly. He had a heart attack in his early 50s. His name was Raymond. And Helen and Raymond had had three children, and two sons and a daughter. And her daughter and one of her sons lived in Beatrice nearby her. Helen was a very likable figure, really cared about her family deeply, especially her grandchildren and great-grandchildren, really loved to babysit children. And she also helped out at the Methodist Church in Beatrice on Sunday mornings. She would help babysit children in the nursery. And she was also, she also liked to go on bus trips. And she would join these groups with the AARP and go on bus tours. And people really took a liking to Helen because she was very affectionate, very friendly and outgoing. And she also liked to take a lot of pictures. So people would actually kind of joke and refer to her as Little Miss Sunshine. And she also loved to take a lot of pictures of her own family members. And one of her famous sayings was "Look natural now," when she would take a picture of somebody. So she just had this special persona, and everybody liked her and loved her. And she lived in February of 1985. She had lived for the last several years in a three-story apartment building that used to be an old telephone company building. It's a three-story sturdy brick building right on the edge of the downtown. So you just walk a block or two and you're right in the middle of the heart of the business district in town. And right next door to her lived her sister Florence, and Florence's husband Ivan, who everybody in the family referred to as Red. So that was really nice, just having Florence and Red right next door to her. Helen didn't drive, so she was able to lean on her family members to help her out, and she was also able to just enjoy meals together too, having her sister right next door and her brother-in-law as well. So it's a very close-knit family. And again, this apartment building was only had about 10 total units in it. About half the people were senior citizens, elderly, and there was also a few 20-somethings, either single women or women that lived with other friends that were, you know, just right out of college or just entering the workforce, if that helps kind of paint a picture as far as what Helen's life was like in Beatrice at that time.
Now, the Daryl and his wife Katie and Helen, Helen had a cold maybe for a couple days, but she had gone out. But other than that, her health was fine. But she was in her home, in her apartment, and Florence was next from next door, and Red were over at Helen's, and they were having, again, what you described, that she's a close-knit family. They were having just, again, get together for an excuse to get together and have a meal, and they departed earlier in the evening. So Tell us just a little bit about that last thing that these people remember, and what state was Helen in just before they left.
So we're talking, I believe it was a Tuesday night, and what's important about that too was that Tuesday night was also when Helen's daughter-in-law, Katie, would have her bowling, her weekly bowling night. So Katie was out bowling earlier in the evening, and Helen's son, her local son, Daryl, stopped by and just, you know, came over, see Mom, cracked open a couple beers. They sat in the living room. Helen's apartment was a small unit. It was, I believe, four rooms. It had an open living room, a very, very tiny kitchen, a very small bedroom, and a bathroom. And that's really about it. But anyway, they spent some time together just sitting around, and Katie had stopped by, I believe, sometime around 9 o'clock or shortly thereafter, after she finished her bowling that night. And I remember it was sometime shortly before the 10 o'clock news came on is when Daryl and Katie both left. And what's really important, too, about that particular night was that it was one of the coldest nights on record in southeastern Nebraska. It was very, very cold, howling winds. Temperature eventually that night is going to dip to about 6 or 7 degrees below zero. Factor in wind chill, it's even colder than that. But that's a key point, because there's not going to be that many people out and about walking around Beatrice, Nebraska on February 5th / February 6th, 1985. Katie and Daryl leave around 10 o'clock p.m. Helen possibly stays up, remains awake for a little longer, eventually goes to bed. And she had been battling, she didn't know it at the time, she was battling pneumonia. She just thought she had a bad nagging cough that she had picked up while she was out in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, which is about 450 miles west. She had been out there just a couple weeks earlier to visit one of her other children, Larry, and Larry's family out there. And it was while she was out there that she picked up this cold, this nagging cough, and didn't realize the severity of this cold. And again, she goes to bed sometime late on February 5th of 1985.
Now, what's happened is, as you write in a book, there's a power shortage in the middle of this, the coldest night on record. And at 6 a.m., as later reported, there's a drifter, or at least an unknown resident, at the Gasson shop, corner store, bought some potato chips. And the clerk just later recalled, well, I think he had some blood on him, but didn't really remember anything about him. Now, Florence lives right next door. Her sister lives right next door. So 9 a.m., she wants to check on her sister. So tell us what happens in the morning with Florence and how things go that morning.
Yeah, so it's Wednesday now, and February 6th, still really cold outside. Florence goes next door, you know, just to figure out where, you know, get Helen out of bed, check on her, just knowing that she had been very sick the last couple days, just to check on her welfare. And she knocks on the door several times and doesn't get a response. She had an extra key. She had a spare key. As family members often do, they have extra keys for different situations. So Florence used her spare key to open up Helen's apartment unit, which was unit number 4. And Florence was battling her own health issues herself. She was having I can't remember if it was glaucoma, but she had very, very poor eyesight. And so she walked into Helen's apartment and wandered through through the unit. She eventually goes to the bedroom, goes back to the living room, and thinks that she sees Helen laying on the floor in the living room, possibly asleep. She goes back and tells her husband, Red, just notifies him, you know, about the situation, because obviously it wouldn't make sense for Helen to be sleeping on the floor in her living room. And Red goes in there next door, and he obviously had better eyesight and immediately picked up on, you know, what had happened here. And he found Helen's nightgown had been pulled up pretty much over her head, exposing her. And he went down and checked her and realized that she, you know, that she was dead. And I should also point out, too, there was a large scarf that had been woven, wrapped around her head several times as well. So you could not see her face, you know, if you approach the body, or you know, it come into this room. So he runs back to his unit. They immediately call the police, and within just a couple minutes, police officers and also an ambulance unit arrive pretty much simultaneously. And this is around 9:30 in the morning now. And the two ambulance technicians or paramedics went up there and touched the body and checked for signs of a pulse and immediately determined that Helen was dead, and she had been dead for quite some time, and they eventually quickly notified the local police chief, Donald Lucaroth, and there was immediate sense that this could be a homicide scene. So the local police acted very carefully to make sure that the unit was preserved and nobody touched anything that they shouldn't.
Now, what you didn't mention, but you write in the book, is that her hands were restrained, and that scarf you talked about acted also like a gag. The sister with the poor eyesight had missed a lot of blood all over the place in terms of the walls. So tell us what the police found. You talked about they were very careful in collecting evidence, and that bears out later in the book. But tell us what again, this is before DNA, or at least any development in DNA. So what did they find in terms of the crime scene besides this obvious rape? But tell us what they did find, what was the description of the place in terms of what did the police find?
So when they get to the scene, one thing they noticed was that the scene was really not in any type of disarray. Helen's body is found on the carpet of her living room. Her underwear, her undergarments had been removed, but there was no sign that they were torn or ripped or anything like that. But it was apparent that somebody had taken them off gently and placed them nearby on the couch. The other things that are important to point out are what was left behind. Helen kept a lot of money in her apartment. She had over $1,000 in cash that she kept in her bedroom top drawer. And she also had several checks and money market accounts that another several hundred dollars as well that were out in plain view, and the conventional wisdom was that if this was some type of robbery or somebody was breaking in to steal, it didn't make any sense to the police why they would completely overlook taking any of this cash that was just out in plain view, especially considering the crime scene had originated in her bedroom. Her sheets and pillows were ripped off the bed. There was a fair amount of blood stains, blood spatter that was found on her bedroom sheets, and also some of it got onto the walls. Police also found underneath her bed a knife, and it was a knife from her own kitchen, but it appeared that the knife wasn't really used to attack her, but it had been used more or less to control her by the rapist. The belief was that the rapist had managed to get inside of her apartment, probably went into her kitchen area, pulled out one of her steak knives, and then used that to gain control by force of Helen in her bedroom. And eventually the attack moved and migrated into the living room, which is where this big scarf was wound around Helen's face, and also some towels from her bathroom, presumably, were used to restrain her hands. This was clearly a sexual assault that turned into a murder. The police didn't see any sign of robbery or stealing of any items or that kind of stuff as being apparent at all. So I hope that kind of covered as far as just kind of give people an idea of what was there at the scene of the crime. And one of the next things the local police did was then they canvassed the rest of the building to find out if any of the other neighbors, the tenants above, the tenants below, had seen or heard anything, and the tenants were of no help at all, as far as just absolutely nobody remembered hearing any loud noises, nobody heard any screams, nobody heard any shrieks or anything breaking or any commotion coming from Helen Wilson's apartment unit 4 that night.
Now, there was also, we forgot to mention, and this will have significance later, but they didn't realize at the time, was a ripped $5 bill at the crime scene. And then tell us as well, as other than the canvas, they soon after have an autopsy. And as you write in the book, the autopsy is very revealing. So tell us what is revealed in that autopsy to police.
The police determined that that there was a significant just signs of penetration as far as sexual assault. There was a significant amount of sperm that was located in Helen Wilson's body, in her vaginal area and also in her rectum area, and it became obvious to the pathologist that performed this autopsy that Helen Wilson had apparently also been sexually assaulted after she was dead. There was belief that the perpetrator had spent considerable time inside of her apartment during the sexual assault and after the sexual assault. He may have been there for at least an hour, possibly 2 hours, but it was apparent that scientific evidence, between the blood, some hairs that were found on Helen's on her nightgown, and then also the sperm, that scientific evidence would be crucial to helping to try to identify who the perpetrator was. And again, this is 1985, so DNA evidence is still in its very, very early stages of research. It certainly was not a common. Common in the courts at all yet. So back in 1985, police and crime labs primarily relied upon serology tests, blood typing tests, and the police were able through the autopsy to determine that the perpetrator, the person that had harmed Helen Wilson, had a B type blood, and that he was also, I believe, a non secretor. This helped them determine that this was a very rare blood type that they were looking for. Less than 10% of the population would have this type of blood type. So from that point forward, the police department in Beatrice, about 20 to 25 member force, made the serology information, kind of the focus of their investigation. When they were interviewing suspects or had leads on potential suspects, they would kind of focus in on whether or not this person had this B-type blood that was a non-secretor, and that would help them guide their investigation. That kind of helps answer that, Dan.
Now, one other thing that's important later again for the audience to bear in mind is that a woman named Kathy Gonzalez lives in the building. She's questioned. Nothing mounts to anything from that. But there is a search in the back of the building, and a bag was found. So tell us what is found in the bag and what police do in terms of with that information. Well, not information, but that material.
The just as part of doing their due diligence, the Beatrice Police Department, obviously, as mentioned before, they went out and interviewed everybody in the building. And one of the questions they asked people, too, was just, did you see any strangers or any weird people lurking around or hanging around the building recently? And Kathy Gonzalez, who lived above Helen Wilson, was recently divorced and had no children. And she worked at that time at the country club. So she told the police, you know, she remembered going to bed the night before. She would watch the movie about the Corsican brothers, and remembered going to bed around 10 o'clock at night. And the police were satisfied with Kathy's interview. They thought that she was just like pretty much all the other tenants, tried to be helpful, but didn't have a whole lot of information to help the police out. When the police were doing their search, they went outside and just checked the dumpster to see by chance if any evidence, maybe the killer threw away, you know, some evidence, a weapon, clothing, anything. And just during their cursory search, one of the many items that was fished out of the trash bin just happened to be a bag that had some old undergarments on there, including some bras. And it was a package that Kathy Gonzalez had thrown away. Her name and I think some letters that she had, some mail was kind of all in the same bag as well. But these bras of hers, at least one of them in particular, had a little bit of blood on it. And at the time, the Beatrice Police Department, you know, just took this in evidence, thinking, well, you know, it's blood, but this probably has nothing to do, you know, with this murder case, since the woman, Helen Wilson, who lived below, you know, had been a victim of a sexual assault and a rape. So bottom line, yeah, the Kathy Gonzalez bras get taken into evidence. They're put into storage at the Beatrice Police Department. But nothing really becomes of them. They just kind of sit around for the next several months and become an afterthought in the murder investigation, Dan.
Now, while police are stumped, and the family is in incredible shock and mourning, you take us back that several hours before the murder, a gentleman named Michael Hyatt is at home shoveling snow. He's a young guy, he's 22 years old, and a friend he knows named Bruce Allen Smith had just come in February 5th to visit. So tell us about this visit and what these two guys do that evening.
Yeah, Hyatt's out there shoveling his snow, and Bruce Smith, who was just kind of a vagabond, who'd bounce around from different towns to town, but he grew up in Beatrice, went to high school there for at least a year or so, but got into severe problems with the cops and ended up at a juvenile detention center in a different part of the state. But Smith still had some family in town. He would have been about 22 years old in 1985. So he comes into town and hooks up with Michael Hyatt. They were friends growing up as teenagers, And so, long story short, Hyatt Steps, shoveling snow, and they go bumming around town for a while. They go cruising around the countryside, kind of telling stories, getting caught up on their lives. And Smith pointed out that he was broke, you know, penniless. He had come in from Oklahoma City, which was where he was living at the time. And so they agree to hook up later that evening at one of the local downtown bars. And Smith shows up around 6 or 7, I believe. Hyatt was already there with another gentleman and a couple girls. And Smith gets pretty wasted that night at the bar. And he even makes comments to Hyatt about how his how he's having an erection at the bar and looking at, kind of scanning over the young women at the bar and stuff like that, and even makes a comment to Hyatt, you know, over a drink, you know, how he wants to get a piece of ass some way, you know, no matter what, that evening. They stay at the bar, I believe, till after midnight, and eventually they wind up all the four of them, I should say the five of them, wind up going out to a real small community, Blue Springs. Blue Springs and Wymore, kind of the same area, but one of the girls that they were with that night had a trailer park out there. So they were going out there just to have a small little after-hours gathering, you know, have a few more drinks, that kind of stuff. While out there, Smith tries to force himself onto one of these young ladies, and it really causes commotion. It causes a scene, and one of the other trailer park tenants that live nearby, he eventually intervenes, you know, and throws Bruce Smith out of the trailer. So it's a really humiliating scene for Bruce Smith, who's enraged and just pissed off as hell at the world, you know, and really mad that he couldn't get a piece of ass that night. Hyatt, kind of the peacemaker of the whole deal, just kind of agrees to, you know, he's going to get Smith out of there and bring this other friend of theirs home that night. So Hyatt puts Smith and the other guy into his vehicle, and it's about a 10 to 15 minute drive back to Beatrice. And it's sometime between 3:30 and 4 in the morning now, too. And again, as I pointed out earlier, it's one of the coldest nights on the record. It's 6 or 7 degrees below zero. Michael Hyatt drops off the other fellow first at his house. Actually, should say he drops the other fellow off first and then pulls up, I believe it's 5th Street and Court Street. It's a popular intersection in town. But that's where Smith agrees to get out. And so Hyatt pulls away, and Smith gets dropped off about a block to a block and a half away from the apartment building, where Helen Wilson's murder and rape takes place that same evening the previous night or early that morning. And as far as with Bruce Smith, then, a couple days later, he's going to eventually drift out of town. But again, he had these issues involving women. And again, as soon as this rape and murder had happened for Helen Wilson, Hyatt even thought to himself that this was kind of suspicious. And he even went to the police and suggested that they look at Bruce Allen Smith as a potential suspect, just given the close proximity, of where the murder had happened, and just Bruce Smith's behavior that night before when they were out drinking, you know, talking about women that night then.
How seriously could they have looked at that recommendation from his friend if, as you say in the book, Smith was charged with rape in 1981? Now, he was never prosecuted, but he was also a suspect in a murder as well. So, do you believe that they actually took that, obviously didn't take that recommendation too seriously?
And I think part of it is because those other crimes involving Bruce Smith had happened in Oklahoma, in Oklahoma City. So the local police in Beatrice, notice that Smith at least was in close proximity to the crime scene. They also knew that they had information that he was involved in a potential sexual assault, you know, out at this trailer park, you know, on the night of the crime. I think the fact that distance was a factor probably caused them to devote less energy and less emphasis on Bruce Smith. And then one thing that's important to point out too, Dan, is that it seems that Smith is completely overlooked. They don't even really think about Bruce Smith in connection with those sexual assaults, those rapes that had happened in the summer of 1983. In 1985, when Helen Wilson's raped and murdered, it's a singular focus. They're only focused in on trying to figure out, you know, who is the culprit of this crime. Even though in the back of their mind, you know, they remember and know that there were these three to four other sexual assault attempts that had happened a year and a half earlier. Even though Smith is on the radar now, they really put forth a lackluster effort, you know, to really dig into Bruce Smith's background, you know, and try to tie him at least to those other sexual assaults. They're eventually going to go out to Oklahoma City the following month, early part of March, and that in my mind was another failure, as far as just that they had an opportunity to interview Bruce Smith while they were out there. But they kind of let the local Oklahoma City Police Department take over the investigation as far as handling Bruce Smith. And it's really weird. It's really odd, as other people have pointed out to me, because as you mentioned, there was at least another murder out in Oklahoma City that at least Oklahoma City authorities were, you know, looking at Bruce Smith as a possible suspect on. And you had this 1981 rape that Smith was arrested for that was never prosecuted out there. But what happens is when the two Nebraska investigators go out to interview Smith out in Oklahoma City, it's the Oklahoma City police that decide that they're going to handle, you know, Bruce Smith. And so he's not questioned at all, really, in connection with this murder. He doesn't even know, you know, that these guys from Nebraska are out there to interview him about this widow's murder. Oklahoma City just is able to get some samples of Bruce Smith just for elimination purposes on this Nebraska case. And that's really as far as it's going to go.
Now, there was the FBI has brought in Special Agent Pete Klimczyk Jr. So what does he say? Did they develop a profile? And in that profile, what do they determine? What is that profile?
Yeah, Klimczyk comes in and does a very thorough job, spends a lot of time in Beatrice, goes through the case file, visits with different people. And he puts together a profile that's very detailed about who the potential suspect is in this type of crime. And Klimczyk is convinced that it's a loner, a young, sexually confused male who's between ages 20 to 25, skinny, probably lives either by himself or with a mother, but just hates women, resents women, and probably has a bad relationship with either his own mother, a grandmother, or an aunt. But just this is somebody that this was an anger, you know, type of an anger retaliatory type of rape. So Helen Wilson was more or less used by the perpetrator to take out his anger and revenge, you know, on other women that this individual had hated. So Klimczyk puts it together, and then he also analyzes the fact that all this money was left behind, how the rapist took no money pretty much from the place. The place is in, you know, it's immaculate. There's no sign of you know, of turned over chairs or, you know, or you know, broken furniture, nothing like that at all. It's this, you know, type of eerie, creepy, you know, ritualistic type of scene, you know, where the scarf was bound around Helen's face. You had these towels that were used to restrain her hands. The fact that the autopsy showed that necrophilia had occurred, so all the signs pointed to that this was a rape, but the perpetrator didn't necessarily intend for Helen Wilson to die in this crime, but nonetheless, that's what happened, very tragically.
We're going to use this as an opportunity to stop to listen to our sponsor, Blue Apron. Now, being a big health and natural food guy, I was very anxious to try the healthy and natural food and unique recipes from Blue Apron. The first meal I tried was a summer vegetable and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplant, shishito peppers, and corn. I was impressed. The food tasted fantastic. The next meal I cooked was the Basque-styled lamb and beef pipe rod. Unbelievable taste, and I cooked it myself. Gourmet meals cooked by me. So you know it was easy to follow the recipes, and the freshness of the ingredients was obvious. The smell and the taste made these meals delicious. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers these and other seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make your own delicious home-cooked meals. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Humanely raised beef, free-range chicken, naturally raised pork, and regenerative farming practices for their produce. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the very best. New recipes are created weekly and are not repeated within the year, so you can choose your meals from a variety of recipes or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe, card, and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals absolutely free, along with free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/murder. You will love how good it feels, how good it tastes to create incredible home cooked meals with Blue Apron. So go to blueapron.com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, as you introduce in your book, and I guess we'll get you to explain a little bit where this Gage County and the Beatrice Police Department, there becomes a shift, and you introduce this incredible character, a former detective with the Beatrice Police, Bert Searcy. And he's in his mid-30s. So tell us in 1985 what Bert Searcy's doing and why he's doing it and his former stint as a police officer and what had happened.
So Bert Searcy in 1985 is working as a hog farmer. He's living in rural Gage County outside of a town of about 75 people. And he had worked previously for about 5 or 6 years on the Beatrice Police Force. Before that, he had worked at his family's grain elevator. He was a welder out there and just did a lot of different odd jobs on the farm. And he left the police department of Beatrice under pretty bad terms. He did not get along with some of the other detectives. They kind of viewed him as a flashy, egotistical, kind of a know-it-all type of guy who really didn't work well with other people on the force, really didn't get along with the police chief who had been there pretty much his whole life and was a very likable, you know, figure in that department. So when Bert Searcy left the police department, police chief made comments to others that he wasn't sad, sorry to see him go. And Cersei then had the audacity to reapply for a job about 2 years later. And the, you know, long story short, the city of Beatrice did not rehire him for the job. This only further deepened the animosity that Cersei had toward the Beatrice Police Department. So when Helen Wilson's murder happens, Cersei starts to think that this is a case and a crime that he had the ability, special skills to solve, and he didn't think very highly of his former colleagues at the police department. So Cersei starts going around town, knocking on doors, you know, and just kind of listening to the small town rumor mill and grapevine as far as kind of who, you know, who might be the culprit of this type of crime. He endears himself to the Helen Wilson's family. The family ran a dry cleaning business in town, and Cersei knew knew one of Helen's daughters, Jan, through this business because he often brought his old police uniforms there beforehand. So the family's grieving, they're in mourning, and they want action. They want somebody to solve this crime, and they want to see it solved quickly. And Cersei was kind of that knight in shining armor for them, as far as at least somebody that presented himself that he was willing, you know, to go to the go to bat for them and do what it took to solve the crime. But again, trouble was Bert Cersei was a hog farmer in 1985, so he nonetheless starts knocking on doors and he eventually gets a tip and develops this this tip that somehow a troubled young woman whose name was Joanne Taylor, who really wasn't from Beatrice but had bounced in the town a couple of different times in her life, but this tip that Bert Cersei gets is that supposedly Joanne Taylor and another fella named Joseph White, supposedly these two had admitted to the crime, that Joanne had confessed that those two were the primary culprits of this crime under a theory that this was a robbery, a pre-planned robbery, you know, that that turned into murder. And the thing is, the Beatrice Police Department, they had heard these kinds of different stories. There was all kinds of goofy stories and rumors floating around town at the bars and stuff like that. So the Beatrice Police Department knew Joanne Taylor. They knew Joseph White. They knew some of their other friends that they kind of hung around with, and really didn't give them any credibility. In fact, Joseph White left Beatrice just a matter of weeks after the murder. But before he did, he even stopped at the Beatrice Police Department and talked with one of the detectives, you know, and showed him his military ID card that he used to have. And Joe White used to have a type, he had type O blood. But White made it clear he was leaving town. He was going back to his home state of Alabama, you know, which is where he grew up, just to make it clear he wasn't running or hiding or, you know, going into seclusion, but he was just leaving because he was homesick and, you know, wanted to kind of move on. There was really nothing for him in Beatrice. But again, Bert Cersei, this hog farmer, just comes up with this theory that this lead, this tip, this gossip, that this local high school girl named Lisa Brown was telling the different people, that Cersei becomes convinced that this absolutely has to be true and that he somehow has got something, you know, that his former colleagues at the Beatrice Police Department just weren't smart enough or were too stupid to follow up on and treat seriously. So 1987, about 2 years later, there had been a new election, a new sheriff elected, a guy named Jerry DeWitt, former Nebraska state trooper, who kind of worked the highways and did road patrol, really had no experience handling murder cases. But Jerry was kind of a showboat. He liked the attention and really didn't have a good relationship with the Beatrice Police Department. But DeWitt gets elected as the sheriff. One of his first things he does is hire Bert Cersei onto the police force at the sheriff's office. And the sheriff is convinced that because Gage County also encompasses the county seat, the city of Beatrice, that therefore that gave him the ability to investigate crimes in the city of Beatrice. So Cersei just keeps pestering him, keeps pestering him for a long period of time. Finally, DeWitt says, okay, fine, you know, he gives in and lets Cersei take over the city's investigation, unbeknown to the city police department, as crazy as that sounds, Dan.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, what he does is that he has connections with the Beatrice police, even though he's been drummed out of there. And what he does find is that the little bit of information, because he doesn't find out very much information. He's not privy to anything, really, because he's not even a police officer. But what he does find out is that there was this ripped $5 bill. And as a result of the $5 bill, what does he theorize, and what does he, as he theorizes, what does he want to make work in terms of that theory?
That's right. So at the crime scene, near the kitchen, Helen's purse was on a table or a counter, and it appeared that the rapist had just kind of rifled through the purse, just kind of as a diversionary tactic, because Helen only had, I think, $20 in her purse at the time, and on the floor, on the carpet, you could see in one of the crime scene photos, one of her keys is on the floor, and there's also this ripped half of a $5 bill that's on the floor. So again, the Beatrice Police Department, they just thought this was a diversion, that there was this was the killer trying to throw them off, the perpetrator trying to throw them off. It didn't mean that much to them. But Cersei develops this theory that somehow this was a crude signature. It was kind of a clue that was left behind intentionally by Joseph White. So Cersei spends a lot of time trying to prove his theory that somehow Joe White was a regular at meeting up with people at parties and ripping up money as part of this trick that supposedly White would do, involving beer parties where he'd rip up a bill and tell people name a president, name a dairy product, and then name a movie, and eventually ends up as Gone with the Wind. But this was very, very sketchy. And most of his friends, denied seeing White ever do this. But Cersei's able to eventually get this teenage informant that he knew, Lisa Brown, to go along with the story, and she tells him that she's seen White do this on dozens of occasions, at different beer drinking parties and stuff like that, that White was fond of doing this. So Cersei's convinced that this ripped $5 bill was just part of Joe White's signature. So that Joe White, after he committed the rape and participated in the murder of Helen Wilson, that he somehow grabbed some money out of her purse and ripped this $5 bill in half, left half of it on the floor to taunt the police as they investigated the crime.
Now, how did they question Joanne Taylor, and what is Joanne Taylor's mental status? Does she have any mental issues or psychological or disabilities and mental disabilities? I don't even know the term anymore, but
yeah.
What is her mental state at that time, and how do police proceed with the questioning? I should say, Cersei, how does he question her?
Cersei gets his arrest warrants back in Nebraska in the early part of March of 1989. So we're talking 4 years and 1 month after the crime. And rather than interview Joseph White or Joanne Taylor before their arrest to even do any background or any questioning, he just gets these warrants to move forward with their arrest. So Joanne is taken into custody in Asheville, North Carolina, where she lived at this point in her life, and Joe White was living around the Cullman, Alabama area, which I believe is about an hour from Birmingham, but they're both taken into custody separately. And Joanne Taylor had numerous serious psychiatric problems. She had been in and out of different psychiatric facilities, during her teens and early 20s. She had had at least two of her children at that point in time had been taken from her by the courts. Just because she was determined to be an unfit parent. She had had a lot of problems with drugs like not just marijuana, but we're talking heavy stuff like PCP, LSD, that type of stuff. Yellow Jackets. She was really into hallucinogenic type of drugs. In addition to having these severe psychiatric problems and delusional behavior, So Joanne, when she's questioned, she's taken into custody in North Carolina, and she goes along with the theory that somehow she might have participated in some crime with her friend Joseph White, whose nickname was Lobo. But the story she gives is about going to a house, a small house, and going there with Joseph White to trim the somebody's trees. And going into the house and asking for permission to get a glass of iced tea, and somehow this turns into this robbery, slash murder, and that Joe White pulled out a buck knife, more or less, and just stabbed this lady numerous times, up and down her body, which was clearly 100% factually inaccurate, because again, this is a three-story apartment building. This crime happened in the middle of winter time. There were no trees to be trimmed in Nebraska, and there was no knife that was used to kill Helen Wilson. Searcy is able to eventually finagle, talk Joanne into changing her story, and eventually getting her to agree that she participated in this crime with Joseph White, and that it really happened in an apartment building, and he's able to work her over, along with some help from a psychologist who also moonlighted on the sheriff's department, a fellow by the name of Wayne Price. Meanwhile, I should point out, Joe White gets taken into custody in Alabama. He's pulled from his house late at night, and he's just aghast. He doesn't know what the hell's going on, can't believe it, and just is amazed and just pissed off as hell, being told that he's being arrested for some murder, of an elderly woman back in Nebraska from some 4 years ago. So he kind of just remains very defiant, and doesn't give a confession, unlike Joanne Taylor, who caved under pressure.
Now, you talk about the tag team of this William Price psychologist, who also happens to be a deputy sheriff, which is a direct conflict if there ever was one. But there are these other people with this, again, tenuous is an understatement, tenuous connection to Joanne Taylor and White. So tell us about Tom Winslow and Debbie Sheldon, and how all these other people come to be suspects in this murder and rape, but also what are their blood types as they do become involved in this and they are checked? What is their blood types?
You have Joanne and Joanne Taylor and Joseph White are the first two individuals arrested, but Tom Winslow was the key for Searcy's theory to come together, because he needed somebody that had an automobile to prove his theory. And Tom Winslow was about the only person in this group of friends that actually had a car. He had a 1973 green Oldsmobile, and Winslow had his own problems in life. He had battled a lot of depression, and was an easy person to manipulate, and he got caught up in his own crime wave a couple years after this Helen Wilson murder. He teamed up with a scoundrel of a guy named Cliff Sheldon, involving a robbery at a motel that left a clerk badly beaten, hit over the head with a tire iron. But Winslow is in the jam since he's in jail for that crime. So he initially denied he had any involvement whatsoever in this crime, this Helen Wilson attack. But knowing that he's in a jam for going to prison for many years, he goes along with Searcy's theory that somehow he let his car get borrowed by Joanne Taylor and Joseph White. And then that's going to snowball and change, and the story is eventually going to transform into Winslow also driving the vehicle, you know, and going up to Helen Wilson's apartment and going inside of her apartment. And where it kind of gets a little crazy is that, again, Searcy wanted to find somebody that had some connection because I'm still trying to figure out how could this be a pre-planned robbery if Joanne Taylor, Tom Winslow, and Joseph White really don't know this Helen Wilson at all, this elderly widow. And that's kind of where Debbie Sheldon falls in the place for Searcy. Debbie was a distant cousin. Helen Wilson was her great aunt, and the family was a little suspicious of Debbie to begin with. She wasn't really all there. She had been in special education throughout high school, and just really struggled in life. She was what even her own lawyer would call as low functioning, very compliant individual, and somebody that would be easy to trick and manipulate. And Debbie initially denied any involvement in this crime as well, but when kind of push came to shove, when she was threatened with the possibility of having her child taken away from her, she changed her story lickety-split and went along with Searcy's theory that Debbie also went to this apartment of her great aunt, and that Debbie was the one that knocked on the door, and her aunt answered the door, and then was bull rushed. Helen Wilson was bull rushed by Joe White, Joanne Taylor, Tom Winslow, and Debbie went into the place as well. Where again it gets confusing is that none of these four individuals have proper blood type that matches up with the perpetrator. If the perpetrator had type B blood and was a non-secretor, all four of them did not have this blood type. So there's going to be a fifth person that's taken into custody, a guy that just happens to have the name of James Dean. And Dean's taken into custody just a couple days after Debbie Sheldon. And same situation with James Dean. He doesn't have the right blood type either. So you got five people now sitting in custody. And a matter of weeks later, finally Searcy found somebody that had type B blood, and that somebody was that Kathy Gonzalez, the woman that had lived in the apartment unit directly above Helen Wilson. And she lived in Colorado at this point in time, and was working at a fish market at a nice hotel in Denver, and just gets pulled out of the kitchen by Searcy and the sheriff, and is told she's being arrested in connection with this murder. And that's kind of at that point in time is when the investigation ends. In Searcy's mind, he at least found somebody with a type B blood. And that could at least put to rest that big fear, you know, that the prosecutor would have to deal with as far as how do we explain this type B blood that was left at the crime scene. They were at least able to pin that on, you know, or blame it on Kathy Gonzalez, and really hope that the defense, whoever the defense lawyers were on this case, wouldn't really delve into this and would kind of overlook the scientific aspect of this case, because the state crime lab determined that Kathy Gonzalez's blood type, although she had a B-type blood, she did not have the same specific genetic markers as the B type of blood that was actually found in Helen Wilson's bedroom.
Right.
And obviously Kathy Gonzalez couldn't produce sperm either. But that was, again, completely overlooked by Bert Searcy and the prosecution team that was going to embark on moving forward with six murder cases involving the death of Helen Wilson.
Now, you talked about the psychologist who was instrumental, as you point out in this book, all the way through, and you show the evidence for that. But also, particularly, you put the blame on Dick Smith, the prosecutor. So tell us about Dick Smith and a little bit about his character and how he goes ahead with this prosecution.
Yeah, and Dick Smith was really, everybody around Beatrice in southeastern Nebraska in the legal community and political community knew Dick Smith. He was a big, burly guy, very authoritative figure, very imposing figure, and he really belittled police officers and really was a micromanager beyond words can even explain, but just really was an intimidating force, and a lot of cops were scared of him. They hated him, but defense attorneys, a lot of public defenders around town, also kind of winced and were really would bend over backwards or would cower to Dick Smith. So in this case here. The art of Dick Smith was really the plea bargain process. Dick really despised or didn't like to take cases to trial. He would either charge what he felt was the right charge, or he would overcharge people, and eventually try to work out a deal with either or their public defender to avoid the protracted time and energy and resources that are spent taking a case to trial. So that was Dick Smith's strategy here with this with these Beatrice Six individuals. And in an astonishing amount of time, barely 2 weeks after Debbie Sheldon was charged as an aider and abettor, as an accessory, I should say, in this crime, Dick Smith was able to work out a plea bargain with her lawyer, Paul Korsland, her public defender. And so that made front page news. But more importantly, that was a domino that had a domino effect. So you had now one key defendant now that had rolled over and was now working with the police, or I should say the sheriff's office and the prosecution to help sink the other individuals. And not long after that, James Dean's attorney, a fellow who was later disbarred for unrelated matters, but a guy named Richard Smelling, who didn't believe in James Dean's innocence. And even though Dean was adamant, absolutely no way he could have been involved in this crime, doesn't remember anything, Smelling eventually gets his client to start meeting with Dr. Price, the psychologist, and Price convinces Dean, that he just he's repressing these memories because it was such a traumatic and horrible event. And eventually convinces Dean that somehow he was there, he was present at the crime scene, and really he's in a jam. He's in a really big hole here, and the only way to get out of this is to plead guilty to a lesser-included felony. He's going to do some prison time, a few years, 5 years, but he's not going to get the electric chair, which was what Dean was constantly told that the sheriff's office was a very real possibility if he didn't, cooperate and agree to start fingering Winslow and Joe White as the ringleaders in this horrible, despicable crime that had happened. So you get two of these individuals that plead guilty really, really quickly. Joanne Taylor, she pleads guilty not that long afterwards as well, even though she can't really remember being at this crime scene. She's willing to go along with what the police are saying because they're the ones saying that she did it, and she's hearing that other people are pleading guilty to the crime. So these people are shown videos of the crime scene. They're shown photos of the crime scene. They're taken from the jail and actually taken to the apartment complex, and walked around in it. So it's really like a horrible, bad movie that's playing out in their lives. But that's the way Dick Smith was operating, because he wanted to get these other individuals convicted. And to do that, he needed to have first-rate witnesses, people that could testify against whoever would remain a holdout or be a defiant individual. And that defiant individual is going to turn out to be Joseph White from Alabama. Real tall, skinny string bean, who really had some minor skirmishes with the law in his life, but nothing, absolutely nothing like a rape and a murder of an elderly woman at all. So Joe White's going to be the lone holdout, and he's going to refuse to accept a plea bargain, really going to anger Dick Smith, knowing that he's going to have to go to the trial, you know, on this case, and spend inordinate amount of time in preparing, you know, for a trial in this crime.
Now the sentences are. Tell us the sentencing.
In Nebraska, at that point in time, typically you would serve half of what you got. So for James Dean, Debbie Sheldon, and Kathy Gonzalez, those three individuals pleaded guilty to a aiding and abetting of a second-degree murder charge. They all received a 10-year prison sentence, and that basically meant that they were going to serve about 5 to 5.5 years at the state penitentiary for that crime. Joanne Taylor also pleaded guilty before Joe White's trial as well. And this was a really shrewd, typical Dick Smith move. He told her that he would argue at the sentencing for a 15-year sentence for her, which in her mind was, okay, I'll be out in 7 years. But there was no way the judge was going to give her a 15-year prison sentence for this crime, considering this was a rape and a murder of an elderly woman. That, you know, this shocked the conscience of the town. So Joanne Taylor is going to get a 40-year prison sentence out of this whole deal. And these are all people, though they didn't get their sentence until after they would testify at Joe White's trial. So in their mind, they were doing absolutely everything they could to appease and please Dick Smith, the prosecutor, thinking that the more they helped, the less time they're going to serve for this crime. And as sad and hard as this may be for listeners to understand, by this point in time, all these individuals had convinced themselves, believed that they somehow were absolutely 100% involved in this crime. They were manipulated by that psychologist, Dr. Wayne Price, and they started to come around and believe that they must have had a blackout. They repressed these memories. They really felt bad and sorrowful for this crime, and felt that they had some culpability and some remorse for participating in this crime. So they were more than willing to go to bat and show up in court and testify and implicate Joe White as the primary perpetrator in this god-awful crime that happened in Apartment Unit 4.
Now this, everybody just figures this is, case is concluded. White continues his battle and is saving his pennies so that he can fight for his exoneration, but it doesn't look good. The other people have resigned themselves. And then a woman at the that was, her and her husband had become friends with Searcy after resigned after his demotion at Gage County. And so Tina Vath, tell us about what Tina Vath does and what happens after 2005, after an attorney, White got someone interested, and you also mention a judicial crusader that fought for post-conviction DNA tests in Nebraska. So tell us briefly about what happens.
Yeah, so Joe White ultimately gets convicted at the jury trial. He gets a life sentence for the murder, and it's... It's after DNA is starting to become more accepted in society that White eventually finds a lawyer named Doug Stratton that's willing to at least explore the possibility to try to get some scientific tests that could be done to determine once and for all whether Joe White and Tom Winslow were in fact the rapists and murderers of Helen Wilson. And just at that point in time, while this is going on, this Tina Vath, who had originally come from Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, she had become friends in the 1990s with Bert Searcy and Searcy's wife, Cindy. by then, Searcy had left the police department, I should say the sheriff's department, and owned a liquor store in Beatrice. And Tina had heard some of these stories from Searcy about how he solved this crime, you know, and became a hero, local hero for this crime, for solving it. And I really didn't know anything about the case, frankly, other than what she had heard, from Searcy's version of events. And eventually what's going to happen is Tina herself is going to become a police officer. She starts as a radio dispatcher at the Beatrice Police Department and then, you know, becomes a patrol officer and is really good at it and is really well-liked in the department. And she's going to become an investigator detective herself. And it's going to be around this this time frame of 2006, 2007 when she's going to get pulled into this case. And it's only along the lines of just trying to determine what evidence still exists, to see whether or not these two convicted murderers can get some of the old evidence tested in the case. And she goes down the basement, and to her department's credit, they had saved all the original evidence from the crime scene and kept it in really immaculate shape. It was saved in cardboard boxes. It was kept in a climate-controlled room in the basement. And so she's going to send out some of these old articles and artifacts of evidence to the University of Nebraska Medical Center for sophisticated and advanced DNA testing. And this is going to be done late 2007, during the early months of 2008. And to kind of speed things up along, it's really going to come back as a shocker for her and the fellow that's the current the new prosecutor at that point in time, a guy named Randy Rittenour. They're gonna learn that that these DNA tests don't come back to Tom Winslow and Joseph White, and that's gonna be a real head scratcher for them. And it's eventually gonna cause the Attorney General's Office of Nebraska to get involved in the case and basically reopen this investigation and kind of start this case from scratch, from ground zero, with the intention of trying to prove that the Beatrice Six were all 100% involved in this crime. And they're going to start this case from scratch and really pull up more of the old physical evidence, send that in for as well for additional testing. And again, these other items that were left at the crime scene don't match up with Joseph White or Tom Winslow and or any of the other four individuals that were convicted long ago for this 1985 murder case, Dan.
Now, with this, you would think, again, there's these forces, and again, you write about it so eloquently, these forces, the Gage County versus Beatrice Police Department and Searcy has his supporters, and this conviction that we see many times, numerous times in other cases where they just don't want to admit any kind of wrongdoing, even if it's obvious, and even in the face of this, in this investigation, and which ends up being police wrongdoing. So you would think that something would happen, that justice would be much swifter, and these, and again, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but these people all eventually get released, but there still is something about compensation, and there is still something about this total exoneration and the fight that against this, against these people, and against their compensation. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's going to be in late 2008, ultimately the six of them are going to be pardoned, and the ones that were still in prison at the time, Joe White, Tom Winslow, and Joanne Taylor, are going to be set free. But that was a good thing. It was the right thing to happen. But the real battle just started from that point forward because the state of Nebraska really dug in its heels at that point in time. You know, and really just kind of dumped them out there. And so they really had no money, no type of there was no retribution for them in place at that point in time. It's going to take them several years just to get the state of Nebraska to cut them a check to make up for the many years of heartache and pain and, you know, agony that they experienced in prison. Many states already had something on the books to offer compensation for prisoners that were wrongfully convicted, but Nebraska didn't at this point in time. So, and then on top of that, then they move ahead with a federal civil rights lawsuit, deprivation of rights case against Gage County and Bert Searcy and Wayne Price, the psychologist, and Sheriff Jerry DeWitt as well. And that's going to become a long, protracted legal battle. The lawsuit gets filed in July of 2009, and the county hires several outside law firms that just really litigate this case to death, basically, just to string it out and drag it out on the county's dime for themselves, but to prolong any type of payment to make amends with these poor, tragic figures here, the Beatrice Six. And it's not really going to be until June of 2016, so just 2 months ago, when their case finally goes to a trial. The first trial ended up in a hung jury. A mistrial was declared. A jury couldn't come up with a conclusion. But the second trial happens just this past June, and they just were able to win a $28.1 million verdict against Gage County and Bert Searcy and Wayne Price, and that's been appealed, and it may take another number of weeks, if not years, before that ultimately gets rectified, Dan.
I don't want to give too much away, and we're going to have to wrap up soon, and I implore people that this is amazing. There's so much more to this story as well. It's very, 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 very surprising. One of the most profound things is the mentally disabled Debbie Sheldon. When the DNA testing is done exonerating her, what does she have to say?
Yeah, that's very strange and odd. And the thing is that the sheriff's officials like Searcy and Dick Smith, this was something that they would love to hang their hat on and kind of help exploit, the Beatrice Six and kind of help, ease any type of public humiliation or disgrace these guys would face back in the community for screwing up this case as bad as they did. But when Debbie Sheldon, gets around for her pardon, and to testify, she still goes along with the story or the belief that somehow she was present, that she witnessed her great aunt's rape and murder taking place, and that she somehow got, knocked out in the middle of this scuffle. But she's still, going along with the story that somehow she must have been involved in the crime, because she had spent the last, 20 years believing that or being manipulated into believing that. So she struggled, with the reality that she had been exonerated and was being told by, lawyers, by the Nebraska Attorney General, who had no incentive in the world, to get involved in this case. It was politically to his detriment, as far as, he made more enemies than friends, as a Republican conservative, to open up this case and then, and tell the town and tell the county, that they had been wrong all these years. So it was politically, not to his advantage to get involved. But again, as you said, with Debbie Sheldon, she's just really struggled, with the reality as far as what's real and what's not real, and it, she still struggles, I think, to this day, frankly. I think she's gone, now she's convinced, in 2016 that she wasn't involved in it. But there's been a long period of time, even when she was set free, where she still questioned whether or not she was present and participated, in this awful crime. This rape and murder of her great aunt.
It's amazing the condemnation that the judge and this trial and this lawsuit, I should say, has for Bert Searcy. So it's very incredible. But you also talk, and it almost looks like a happy ending here for Joseph White. He reunites with his high school sweetheart, and despite these 20 years in prison, tries to rebuild his life and is looking forward to some of these people hadn't agreed to settlement, so he had received $25,000 and was awaiting his $475,000 and was going to get married, and had basically essentially grabbed hold of his life again and gotten it back. We'll leave it at that, because I said there's many things in this book that in the end of this book you talk about, and again, still more fascinating information that we haven't covered that I'll leave for people to discover themselves in this book. I want to thank you very much, John, for coming on and talking about this. If people are interested in, is there any way through Wild Blue Press that there is signed copies available? And tell us about your website or contact information if people are so interested.
Yeah, to buy a signed copy, Dan, I would suggest for listeners to go directly to my website, which is johnferrak.com, johnferrak.com. And I have Failure Justice available there, along with three other true crime books that I've written as well on cases out of the heartland. And again, for everyone else, certainly you could find Failure Justice on Amazon. You could find it through Barnes & Noble. It's available through most bookstores, but again, Kindle versions, ebook versions are very popular these days, and also the audiobook was produced by Kevin Pierce, who's a well-known true crime narrator who's done numerous true crime books and does a fascinating job. So again, for audiobook listeners, I would suggest to give the Kevin Pierce version of Failure of Justice a try.
Well, that's great, John. Thank you very much for this interview. A Failure of Justice, A Brutal Murder, An Obsessed Cop, and 6 Wrongful Convictions. What a story. Thank you very much, John. You have a great evening.
Thank you very much, Dan. You do as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.